Sublime to the suspicious. As always, I'm your host, Lindsay Wilkins, and this is going to be a great double feature. It's got gothic horror, mad scientists, teenage hormones, Robert Downey Jr., and whatever that thing Bill Paxton turns into. So yes, if you haven't guessed, it is a double feature of James Whale's masterpiece, Frankenstein from 1931, and John Hughes's Weird Science. And I have a fantastic guest. He is the host of the Action Drunkies podcast. Of course, it's the cinema drunkie himself. It's Rob Antiquera.
Anyway, how's it going?
I am fine. I am fine. This can be how. Thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate this.
No, thanks for so much for coming on. As I said, I have been loving the Action Drunkies and have been learning so much. The deep dives you go into and how you really get into the likes of Andy Sedaris and the latest one on the Mortal Kombat have been absolutely just so fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you. Greatly appreciate that.
So how's everything going with the podcast? And you also go on to the House of Screams podcast as well, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. Podcast is doing great. Both podcasts, by the way. We're in our second season of the Action Junkies at the moment. We're also in our fourth season of The House That Screams at the moment. And both are doing very well. Couldn't be happier how everything is turning out. And everything's doing great.
No, that is great. And both of them have been going really well. And with that, we're going to be getting into this amazing double feature of Frankenstein and Weird Science. Now, I always ask guests if we're going to be sitting down and actually watching this double feature to bring some trailer ideas of what they would show beforehand. What would be your first trailer idea?
My first trailer idea was Dracula's Daughter.
Look at me. What do you see in my eyes?
Yes.
Do you like jewels, Lily? This is very old and very beautiful. Please don't come any closer. I am Dracula's daughter.
Yes.
We you and me, I talked a little bit about how much we both love Dracula's Daughter. I absolutely love that movie. It's one of my all-time favorites. I actually go back and forth in between which one I like more, the first Dracula with Bela Lugosi or that one. Depending on my mood, but I really do love Dracula's Daughter.
No, Dracula's Daughter blew me away when I first saw it because I watched the original Dracula at least once or twice a year. And just to sort of have this amazingly goofy a movie with so much pathos is absolutely incredible. I mean, the first thing you do and see in Dracula's Daughter is Edward Van Sloan, who plays Van Helsing, get arrested for murder two Keystone cops. And then you meet this amazing woman who is struggling with her vampirism and also, I guess her queerness as well, and it's just there's a lot going on in this movie. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, most definitely. Like I always love the attack scene where she attacks Lily.
Yes,
and, it's an attack scene, but it also plays like almost like a seduction. Where she's like, "You like jewels, Lily? It's very old and very beautiful. I want to show it to you." I love that scene so much.
It is. It's just this really soulful movie, and it would make a really great trailer before jumping into Frankenstein.
Oh, absolutely.
My first trailer, I am going to go with Island of Lost Souls from 1932.
Island of Lost Souls. Good movie, bad trailer. This is one of my favorite monster movies. The brilliant Charles Laughton really is extraordinary in this picture. Bela Lugosi turned down the role of the Frankenstein monster because he didn't want to be unrecognizable. He realized his mistake, played the Sayer of the Law, unrecognizable. This is the first movie version of the H.G. Wells pamphlet, really. It's a novella called The Island of Dr. Moreau, which was written as a fundraiser. It's an anti-vivisectionist tract. Laughton plays Moreau, the maddest of mad scientists, who through surgical means is taking animals and turning them into humans. This is before the Hays Code, and this movie's remarkable for its overt sadism and sexuality. H.G. Wells hated this movie.
Which is a bat crazy movie. It does have Bela Lugosi in it as well, to continue on with the Dracula theme, but also a insane performance by Charles Laughton, who's kind of playing the Dr. Moreau. This is kind of, it's one of those movies that is might be one of the more pre-code of pre-code movies. You haven't seen this one, have you, yet?
No, which is really a shame on my part, because obviously it's based on the book, The Island of Dr. Moreau, by H.G. Wells, who is my all-time favorite author. And the fact that I haven't seen it, shame on me.
Oh, no, you're in for a treat when you do actually see it, because there's some, I think it sort of, like a lot of this time, takes what the book does and then just goes in completely different directions. But there is just some really bizarre moments where you're just like, am I watching this in a movie? What is happening?
Oh, that sounds great. That sounds great. I got to check it out soon.
Oh, there's a panther lady, and what happens? With, oh, it's so great. And then, yeah, Bela Lugosi turns up, and you're like, oh, shit, this is a party. It's an amazing, amazing movie, and I can't wait to hear what you think about it when you finally do watch it.
Most definitely. I'll let you know the minute I see it.
What's your second trailer for Frankenstein?
Well, my second trailer was actually Werewolf of London.
Seize the only specimen of the Marifaza plant in England. That flower is the only known antidote for werewolfery.
A very interesting folktale, but of no value to the police.
I warn you, sir, unless you secure this plant, there'll be an epidemic that will turn London into a shambles.
When my experiments are completed, I will show their results to the entire world, not before.
Remember this, Dr. Glendon. The werewolf instinctively seeks to kill the thing it loves best.
I know like the big one is the Wolfman with Lon Chaney Jr., but I actually really enjoy Werewolf of London. Because he's a monster also, but like, you know, it's like more like Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. In this case,
it really is. I watched this last night, actually, and you're right. This is very much a sort of almost like a Jekyll and Hyde story. That is the perfect thinking of it.
Yeah, most definitely. But yeah, I really love that one a lot. I even like the makeup design. It's not as wolf-man-ish as the Lon Chaney version, but I like the way it looks, kind of like almost like Eddie Munster-ish, if you will, before Eddie Munster. I really enjoy that one a lot. I think it's great. So yeah, that's the one I wanted to be for my second trailer.
No, it's actually got a really cool transformation sequence as well before he turns into that sort of Eddie Munster, when he's kind of walking and you see him slowly transform, but every time he goes into a shadow, he comes out even more transformed. It's actually quite a cool way of doing it. I mean, not as revolutionary as, say, the Wolfman, where you're sort of watching the I can't remember the exact technique they used to do it in front of your eyes, but it's still a really kind of creepy atmospheric transformation. So that's an excellent trailer.
Yeah. It's more creative, if you ask me, visually, to have him, like, you know, the hidden wipes as he turns into the Wolfman. I actually prefer that version of a transformation than the one with this slow dissolves in the Wolfman.
Yes, you're absolutely right. That is great. My second trailer, I'm going to go for something a little bit different. I'm going with Body Parts from 1991. Jeff Fahey.
You lost your arm in a car accident yesterday. We've transplanted another arm for you.
How does it feel to have someone else's arm?
Dad, it's sort of gross.
Well, it's not how it looks, it's how it works, right? I think there's something the matter with me.
Oh!
It's the arm.
Billy!
What's going on?
There's something wrong with the person he used to belong to.
You have this guy's arm. You don't have his personality.
I want you to run my prints. Any past record I had would show up on the printout, right? You put a killer's arm onto my body and you didn't tell me.
That arm can't do anything you don't want it to.
How do you know that?
This movie's that crazy. It's kind of a remake of one of my all-time favorite movies, Mad Love with Peter Lorre. But you have a man who's been a terrible accident and he gets, I think a new arm or something.
His arm.
Yeah.
His
he gets
arm.
A new arm, yeah, because in the Mad Love it's his two hands. But he gets a new arm, which likes to murder people. And then he has to go on a hunt for other people who got transplants from the same guy. It's an amazingly bat-crazy movie. I love watching Jeff Fahey at 11 and he goes there. It's also got Brad Dourif. It's kind of a magic movie of mad scientists going completely bonkers.
Yeah. I also like how the mad scientist character is a woman and, you know, like very cold and calculating a person. I actually kind of enjoy that aspect of it.
Yeah, you're right. There aren't actually enough mad scientists, a lady mad scientist, which we need more of, because she is very cold and calculating. And those final images when you see what she's actually doing is just, it's so great.
Yeah, most definitely.
And with that, we will be getting into James Whale's amazing masterpiece, the 1931 Frankenstein.
When this dead hand moves, the monster created by a man they called Mad is turned loose to strike terror into the hearts of men. To shock women into uncontrolled hysteria.
Elizabeth!
To prey upon the innocence of children. This is the story you've heard about, talked about. The spine-tingling, blood-chilling story that stuns your emotions. Frankenstein!
Don't touch that!
Now I'm kind of glad you got me to rewatch this. But I guess I'll ask you sort of first, what is sort of your history with this movie?
Oh, well, as a kid, when I was younger, like I didn't really like horror movies.
Mm.
I was scared of them, but like I ever so surely, slowly but surely started getting into them. Like I delved into them, like, through like little gateway horror films like Child's Play and The Gate, and then started getting into harder edge stuff. But then, like, as I got into horror, I wanted to experience it more, and I decided to like take it on, like, through all like regions and times, the like, especially with the classics. And I used to watch the Sci-Fi Channel a lot as a kid, back before it was SIFI, whatever they call it now.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, but like back when it was the Sci-Fi Channel, they used to show like old classic stuff like The Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, Tales from the Dark Side, and they used to show old monster movies, especially the Universal ones and the Hammer horror ones. And that's where I really got my fill of it. I would sit in the middle of the living room with the lights off, you know, my popcorn, you know, maybe like 9 or 10, and just watch these old Universal horror movies, you know, Dracula and this one, as well as The Mummy and The Wolfman and The Invisible Man. Like all those stuff, I loved all those. But Frankenstein and The Mummy were my particular favorites. Of course, you know, the connecting tissue being Boris Karloff. But Frankenstein was probably the one that stuck out to me the most, more than any of the other ones. And when I was old enough to get my own VCR, Frankenstein was one of the first tapes that I bought back when, you know, there was VHS. I'm really showing my age here.
I know. Love to hear the mummy love, because I love that 32 mummy. Oh, it's absolutely great.
I love it. I love it to death. It's so fantastic.
Oh, it's so good. I had a similar thing. Like, as a kid, I hated, I was terrified of horror movies. So I was always sort of, if there was one on, I was always one foot out the door just to run away. So yeah, you sort of get into those little gateway horrors, and then, I loved Beetlejuice as a kid, so I kind of liked the trappings around it, but just never could dive in. And then slowly. And then you're right, when you do start watching horror, you want to kind of see what else is out there. And seeing these kind of classic Universal monsters is just amazing, to see what kind they were doing. I was always more of a Bride person. Like, I would, and I have to still do this, I keep going back and watching Bride, just because it's so maniacal and Wales just doing so many weird things with it.
Mm-hmm,
Tonal shifts and everything like that. So when I went back and watched this one, it was kind of incredible about how dark and gothic it was. I mean, it's I was sort of surprised, because James Whale likes to sort of mix tones and be kind of funny and not cute, but he kind of likes just to sort of try different things and to try and shock the audiences in different ways. But this one has gothic oozing out of its pores.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most definitely. That's a great way of putting what Brian is weird. I love those touches. But yeah, this one is a lot more serious. There's, you know, you have your little comedic moments with Baron Frankenstein.
Yes.
Played by Frederick Curry. Like, yeah, he's definitely the comedy relief of the film. But yeah, this one's a lot more darker than, like, I can just imagine people going from Frankenstein to Bride and just being surprised at the tonal shift, you know, with that one being a lot more funny and comedic, and this one just being really just brutal. Like, that's one of the most fascinating things about this movie, because when this came out, you know, the amount of shock and like that just the audience had, you know, when this movie premiered, like, this was the, you know, pinnacle of violence on screen at that time. You know, like, you look at it now and it's kind of tame, but back then, you know, you had strangulations, you had hangings, of course the pivotal scene where the sharp featured man throws Maria into the lake was so shocking that they had to remove it for prints of the movie for years and years. And like, even if you watch an HD version, like of the movie, that scene is still like kind of like not as upkempt,
and yeah, it's still, you're kind right.
of, yeah, like the quality's not as good because it was gone from the movie for so long, you know. So, like, I just find all that stuff fascinating. Like, just you know, I mean, consider where we are now with horror, when you have stuff like a Serbian film and like Martyrs and Frontiers, like all that, you know, violence that's just completely out there, like, you know, in the scope of it. And just to think that, like, what we have now with those films I just mentioned, like, that was... This Frankenstein was like that version of that kind of movie back then. And I can't imagine like the audiences in the theater just watching this stuff and just being like, oh my God. You know, like, you know, the pearl clutching, like, just, yes, someone think of the children.
Yes. Oh, and they did, because they did cut out that scene. But no, you're absolutely right with that. I was sort of watching it even going, holy shit, I forgot how dark this movie was, because you do, even it starts with Edwin Van Sloan coming out of the curtain, like it's Simpsons Treehouse of Horror, saying, yeah, you know, think of the children. Going, what you're about to see is violent and dark. And I think even now the movie still kind of lives up to that, because as soon as poor little Maria comes on screen, I'm just like, oh no, the poor little girl, because it's not exactly like it's a much more sadder violence, because the monster or the creature doesn't understand what he's doing. Like in Serbian and Martyrs, there's a much more calculated thing of, yeah, like, oh, this is going to fuck people up, which I actually still have not seen them because of, I'm worried about what I'm going to see.
Right.
Even though I understand kind of the purposes behind them and everything like that. But this one, to be sitting down in a theater in 1931, and then first seeing you have that, and then you see, literally introduced to your main character, stealing a body. Like, it's kind of ballsy to open the movie that way. This is your introduction to Colin Clyde. He's stealing a body. There is no kind of him being charming or anything like that. It's literally him cutting down a condemned hangman and digging up another body. And I kind of love this about this movie. This is a movie that is starting, like, nope, there is, you will meet charming people throughout this movie, but your hero is doing things that you find repulsive, and he's going to be making something that you will find repulsive. And it is just, as I said, the gothic just oozes out of this movie through its pores. Every single moment it feels that this very sad, melancholy violence to it. And it'd be, yeah, as you're sort of saying before, the clutching of the pearls, because people would have seen people would have seen Dracula just beforehand. And even though that movie was kind of also revolutionary for its time, Bela Lugosi was charming. He was this guy who you knew was dangerous, but you couldn't stop watching. I would love to have seen audiences' reactions of watching the people you're meant to root for are the kind of the side characters almost. It's, I don't know, this movie blew me away on this watch.
Yeah. Like, speaking of Dracula, like, even that, like, it was considered a bit, like, much on the violence tip, and they actually held back on showing, like Lugosi's Dracula. They didn't even show his fangs, or like when he attacked any, like, you know, they would fade away, or like the spoiler alert for like nearly the however old that movie is.
90, I think, at this point.
yeah, it's very old, but spoilers if you haven't seen a movie that old before. Yeah. When he gets staked at the end, you don't even see it, you hear it, but you don't see it. You hear like his death cries, and even that was a bit much for audiences back then, you know. It was just like his you could just imagine, like, oh my god, he's dying off screen, I can't take all this violence.
You gotta remember, Sam was only 2 years old at this point. To hear someone dying on screen was probably just like, holy shit, what am I watching, what am I hearing?
Most definitely.
For some reason, just because I'm so used to Bri, just, you know, it's open up on this lovely kind of thing with Lanchester sort of going, yes, I'm going to tell you a lovely story about a doctor and his monster and his in Pretorius and my only weakness. And then to sort of see Colin Clive just digging up a body, it is absolutely amazing. And then to be introduced to the monster who, that first time you see Boris Karloff in the makeup, it is just a holy crap moment.
it really is. You could tell they planned on it too, because they have him walking backwards and then that turn around, and then those like two hard cuts into his face, like boom, boom. Mm. Like, you could just imagine the shock of the audience back then.
That it's dead quiet, like there's no sound when you sort of see the back, he's sort of walking in, like, of course he's just trying to figure out how to use his everything else, let alone how to walk forwards. And then he turns around and there's two hard cuts, and the audience were just going, holy shit, because that is, it's kind of a harsher makeup than I think in Bride. And Jack Pierce was a well-known genius during this time, but it's just amazing. I mean, Boris Karloff was actually quite a tiny person. And I always love when you're watching, have you ever seen The Black Cat?
Oh, I have not.
Oh, another movie you're going to be in such a treat for, because it's like another, these two are my heroes. Who am I meant to choose between these two dark things? But it's Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. And you can quite clearly see Bela Lugosi is like 2 inches taller. and then taller than Frankenstein. And it's an amazing, amazing, again, dark, what am I watching on screen kind of movie. And this kind of quite slender creature with these 13-pound shoes and this makeup kind of coming into the room, and then it just changes the energy. I mean, James Bond knew what this image was going to do, and he just went full tilt with it.
Right. I think the probably like the makeup really is just, you know, iconic. Of course, that's how majority of people identify the Frankenstein monster as, you know, just that Jack Pierce makeup.
Yes.
But I think it's the makeup, like, as iconic as it is, it doesn't work without Karloff. Because like Karloff was just an incredible actor, performer, and it's like, The makeup is one thing, but it's the eyes. I think the eyes that do it. Like the close in, you see those eyes, and it's just so haunting and effective. That's what scares you the most. It's just like the darkness of those eyes, those haunting eyes he has. I think that's what makes it that much more scary with that close up. Like the makeup is one thing, but the eyes is just totally adds to it all.
Yes, and the fact that he's a living creature under there, because they are these dark, soulful. You're right, absolutely right on that point. It's kind of got this, you do realize it's a living creature under there who is got all these emotions going on, and he's absolutely amazing at portraying it. I mean, he wasn't even credited in this movie. I think it was just the monster ... And he gives this amazing performance of just doing so much with so, so little that you absolutely understand what this creature is thinking and feeling at any given moment.
Right, most definitely. Like, as you see, it was such a fantastic performance that just a year later when he did The Mummy, like, he went from just the question mark, he went to, like, Karloff, the uncanny on the poster.
Yes!
You know, which shows, and I think that they were looking for that because, you know, this was after Lon Chaney, The Man of a Thousand Faces, and everybody was looking for, like, that replacement, you know, how do we replace, you know, The Man of a Thousand Faces? And, it, like, it's just, like, you know, that those kind of transformative performances really is what worked at audiences back then. That's why Lon Chaney was so popular, not just, you know, because he was an incredible actor, because he really transformed himself. Even to this day, you know, Lon Chaney's presence is kind of felt, because you really see, like, in the Academy, they award those kind of performances overall. Like, you know, like, you have DiCaprio, who put in great performance after great performances, and he got snubbed until he did The Revenant, and he had to, like, really transform himself. And most recently with Joaquin Phoenix and Joker, where he had to really lose all the way to skin and bones and the paint and makeup to really transform himself. So it's like, you see, like, even then, like, from then till now, like, Lon Chaney's presence is really felt with acting, and like his loss was a great one, so they were really looking for it. And Karloff fit the bill, you know, because he was an incredible actor, and he willing to do the makeup thing. So, like, you could see that's why he was welcomed with open arms. So, like, he became a superstar overnight with this one performance. You know, he was mostly doing bit parts. I know he was in Scarface. He had a bit part in that, where he played one of, you know, enemy gangsters, and he gets, you know, he gets Tommy gunned up, and you know, then he did this movie, and he was just became just a superstar overnight. So it's really great, because he deserved it, because he was just an incredible performer.
He really was. I mean, the man could do anything. And I love the point you made about the Lon Chaney, how it still affects the acting in Hollywood and what kind of performances get recognized. God damn it, you're actually really right. Anyone who sort of changes their, like, I'm always sort of worried about Christian Bale, about if he's going to die early, because he keeps losing weight, gaining weight, losing weight. But it's that whole Lon Chaney thing. And I just recently watched The 25th Phantom again. And you're right, it's his presence and his makeup and the way he kind of constructs the masks that completely takes over that movie. Boris Karloff does, you're right, similar thing. I think he does it in this amazingly different way. Like, he's a little bit more of a quiet performer, but in that everything, it's so loud from his quietness. Like when he's being beaten by Fritz to try and control him, and the way he's just sort of cowering and trying to make himself smaller when he's this kind of odd-shaped, yeah, he knows how to use the odd-shapeness of the makeup and the clothes that they've given him and the shoes. He doesn't fit in, and he's constantly trying to fit into something in an environment where it's just never gonna work.
Right, absolutely. Most definitely. Also got to point out the Dwight Frye is another fantastic performance. I love Dwight Frye. I thought he was great. His name is Fritz, by the way, not Igor. No, I'm not correcting you. I'm saying it for the audience out there who seems to still think he's called Igor after, like, it's Fritz. It's Fritz, people.
Fritz.
Stop calling him Igor.
No, the thing is, I think I did call him Igor for a number of years. I just couldn't accept that they were calling him Fritz. And then a few years ago, I was watching it and going, oh, yeah, it is Fritz. He's not actually an Igor. He doesn't have a hump. He's not doing the whole thing from Young Frankenstein, Marty Feldman thing. It is very much a straight up, it's just a straight assistant who's an asshole because I just... He is such an asshole in this movie. I love it. I mean, I love Dwight Fryer. I wish he made more movies. I just haven't found the ones that he was in the early 30s. It was just, yeah, he's this cast is amazing. I mean, Bay Clark, Edward Van Sloan, Colin Clive, who looks so fresh-faced in this movie. I mean, his liver hasn't given up on him yet. I'm looking at him going, oh, your face looks healthy. You look full of life, unlike in 35, even though I love those two movies he's in. I don't have Victor Kerr, who plays Baron, who's, I love him so much. He is and it's also Henry Frankenstein in this movie. He's not actually... Victor. I think he has a brother called Victor, which I always found a bit strange. But absolutely amazing in this.
I gotta admit that I always found that weird. They changed his name to Henry in there instead of Victor, and you have a character called Victor in there. So it's like, what was the problem calling him Victor? But yeah, Colin Clive does. I don't know if he gets enough credit. Because he's the one who's doing all the heavy lifting. Karloff walks away with the picture. Hmm. There's no doubt about it. But Clive is doing so much heavy lifting. Like, you know, the way he, like you said, the way he's introduced in the movie, he's stealing bodies. But he basically crawls up Fritz's back, like, down, you fool. Mm. And like, you see this man who's on the cusp of madness. You can see it all in the eyes. And then when they steal the body, and the way he just, like, he's looking into the camera, the neck's broken, the brain is useless, we must find another brain. You know, it's such a brilliant performance, and it was inevitable that he would get overshadowed by such a, you know, masterful performance by Karloff, but I really think that he deserves a lot of the credit too, because he's putting in so much work and he's so great in the movie. And
I was just agreeing with you because he's one of my favorite Dr. Frankensteins. He is mad, am I? I don't know. It's just he's walking this thin line of being the movie's villain, being its hero, he's the one who's kind of pushing everything forward. I mean, the scene where May Clark and the other guy comes to sort of see him and go, look, you need to come back and you can't keep doing what you're doing. This is insane. And his justification for it of like, no, I am God. I am creating life. I mean, come on. And of course the iconic it's alive. He's alive. Is just, yeah, he's doing so much in this movie. And yes, he's kind of the straight man to, Frankenstein's, Hardy, it's just this. Yeah, you're right. It's an incredible performance, and I love his Frankenstein, even in Bride as well, when he's kind of a bit more demure and kind of taking second fiddle to Pretorius. He's still got this amazing presence about him, and I love watching him on screen.
Yeah, most definitely, most definitely. Mm. I was just thinking about the "It's Alive" moment with the one of another shocking moments, the blasphemous line when where Victor says, "Oh my God, it's the God. Now I know what it feels like to be God." And that was a line that was removed for years. Even on tape, like, they had the scene in there, but the line was muted. Like, it was covered with a thunder strike, so you couldn't actually hear it.
Hmm.
But that was another shocking moment. Like, oh my God, blasphemy in this major motion picture. How dare you?
Yes. No, and the fact that still people were upset when John Lennon said we're bigger than Jesus. So it was still a very touchy subject for a long time. But no, that's what I love about the Frankenstein mythos in general, is that you have a guy who's essentially becoming his own god, and the havoc this basically just wrecks on everyone around him. And the 31 Frankenstein captures this perfectly, because when he realizes what he's done and he has to go into sort of hero mode, it's absolutely incredible. Like, he's like, no, this is my creature. I birthed him into the world, and I've got to take him out. And it's amazing the switches he takes, because he's horrific, insane, and then heroic, all within a span of an hour 15 minutes. I mean, this is a universal monster movie. This is a lean and mean machine that gets in and out very, very quickly. And just the kind of modes he goes through is absolutely incredible.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Yeah, like, I was always, I don't know if say amazed, but impressed. I'll say impressed by, like, how they tell a full story. Like, you know, story as full as the one of Frankenstein, as quickly as it did, you know, by just, like, munching everything for the most effective. Also, what strikes me about the movie the most is this lack of a music score.
Yes.
Yeah, like, as you know, in most horror movies, the silence is the most scariest thing. Mm. James Wan, of course, is known to use it well.
Yes.
Like, in his scary movies, like, you know, a character walks in a dark room and it's silent, and, you know, you're waiting for something to happen, and that unsurmountable sense of dread just takes over you because you're just waiting for it to happen, and it's nothing, and it's going longer and longer and longer until something finally does happen. And this whole movie feels like that. It's like an hour and 15 minutes of dread, just, you know, because it's just silent, no music, there's no da-na-na, you know, taking over the proceedings. So you're just scared anything's going to happen at any moment in the movie. Of course, when Dr. Waldman is looking on the creature, and that hand comes up behind him, and it's just like, oh no. And just the lack of music just makes it even more creepy and scary as the arm comes up behind him and starts strangling him. Like, I know people who are just like, oh, I wish it had music. I don't. I think it's fine as is without the music.
No, I think it's much more effective, because every single time the monster kind of is really going to get into gear, it is always dead silent, except for maybe poor Maria, because she's just chatting and talking the whole time. Like, she's being a kid, she's playing, she's found a friend to play with, and the creature just does not understand that a little girl is not a daisy. That's kind of why it makes it that scene particularly horrific, because you know no one's really at fault, but everyone's at fault. And then when her father's just taking her back to the village, it's like, oh no.
That is a devastating image when he's carrying her lifeless body into the village. It is really, like, especially the way the actor portrays the scene, like, you know, where he's just completely destroyed, like, you know, just all the life is gone in his face as he's holding his daughter's lifeless body in his arms. It's a really striking image.
No, that's the point I was getting to. There are sort of real consequences to everything you're saying, especially when Dr. Walden is murdered. You see that hand and you just... Yeah, you're right. It's like when you're walking into The Conjuring and there's dead silence and you're just waiting for something to come out of the corner. It's very much like this movie. And you get that kind of... but it's always the payoff. It's always so completely horrific. And especially when he's kind of following Maria in the wedding dress and she turns around and all she can do is absolutely scream. These are really effective moments, and still as bone-chilling, kind of as bone-chilling, even though we've seen much more horrific things, they've got that quality where you just go, oh God, it still manages to capture that quality. And I think it's because of the way that Whale uses silence.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Most definitely.
Yeah, I'd love how this movie just keeps upping the ante, and you still get those payoffs. That are still as dark, and you're just watching going, I can see how people were watching this movie and going, no, sorry, just no, I can't. We need to cut out that, we need to mute that line, what is going on here? And I've absolutely had moments, especially going back to being a kid and just looking at the screen of something horrific and just going, nope, sorry, that's not going to cut, and then just leaving the room. And so I can sort of imagine audiences just not realizing what they're about to get into. And it's just, it's so, oh God, this movie's amazing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I cannot say enough good things about this movie. I love it so much. As a matter of fact, interesting little bit of trivia, if you can call it that. As you mentioned before, I'm on the House of Screams podcast, and I've been on there since season one.
Yeah.
And now like we talk about a film throughout from season two onward, we talk about a specific movie, and we'll pick a quote from that film, and then we'll say it as our introduction. When we're introduced, we'll say a quote from the film before we go off into our discussion on the film. But in the first season, it was more like horror topics, like our host Candy the Final Girl. She would pick topics for discussion concerning horror, and that's what we would discuss. And like some of us had like different intro that they would do, like just their own personal intro, and so, and the half of us would have personalized intro that they would do every episode. I was one of those individuals, and my intro was "How do you do?" which of course, as I took from Mr. Edward Von Sloan from the very opening line of the movie.
Yes.
So, like that's how Frankenstein, much I love it, though, how much it means to me, where it's like that was my choice for intro line, was the opening line of that film.
It's such a great intro, though. I love that when he's just behind the curtain, just like, "How do you do?" And this very polite way of saying, "This movie's fucked up." Just essentially what he says, and this very polite way, this very nice man coming out going, "Now, what you're about to see on screen may shock you." And it's just, I kind of think it sits, and then you go into the that first scene, and it's such this kind of disconnect, because I don't think I've actually ever listened to what he sort of says, because I've always sort of grown up with The Simpsons and Marge Simpson coming out from behind the curtain going, "Look, I apologize for my family. I'm a little embarrassed." And then to sort of go into that hard cut of Frankenstein in the graveyard, it's just this kind of weird disconnect. And it was just literally sort of saying to audiences going, "No, you're going to see some stuff you might not be ready for." And that's kind of what I love about pre-code movies in general. They were trying stuff. They were trying to see how they could really shock and get emotive responses from the audience until the Hays Code was really, really started to be put into effect. But they kind of went all out. And this is one of the great examples of James Whale kind of looking at it, because I know he didn't want to make the sequel, and I know he was just a director for hire, but this sort of gave him some sort of clout. And he was like, "Oh, you want a horror movie, do you? Well, I'm going to absolutely give you a horror movie." And even though the term wasn't coined as a genre until 1934, he kind of already knew what the genre was, already knew how to manipulate audiences, kind of get them sucked in and then shock them. And no wonder people had this kind of adverse reaction to parts of it, because he knew how to suck you in and then just kind of, "Oh, and then you're going to see this."
No, you're absolutely right. Most definitely. Like, Whale did an exceptional job. Like, I know, like, it wasn't for forte, but it's like, "Oh, this is what you want? Okay. Okay, I got you." And then he gave him the fucked up shit. And then, like, by the next one, they're like, no. And, okay, now you don't want that. Okay, all right. You know, my job is done. Yes. You know, which allowed him to do, like, what he really wanted to do was have these weird little artistic choices, creative choices in The Bride. You know, Whale was a fantastic director, a true legend of cinema, and God bless the man, you know, for everything, all his contributions to cinema.
Exactly. He really, I've got this sneaky suspicion he liked to keep audiences on their toes, because when you watch Say Invisible Man, and he is just this outright bastard of a, just like the body count and Invisible Man as well as here. It's just, I love it. And just to have him skipping down the road when you realize he's naked, and then, you know, you hear Claude Rains singing about being autumn, and you're just like going, "Oh, God damn it, bless you. Bless you, Whale. I love you so much."
Absolutely.
It's just, he had this greater sense of humor, and he maybe wasn't able to show it in this because he was like, "Oh, well, I'm just going to scare the pants off you in this movie," which he did to, or shock you, and to absolutely. And then he just got to go, "You know what? I'm going to be me, and my movies are maniacal, mad, crazy things." And you do really get the sense of crazy in this movie as well, because purely of Colin Clive. I mean, he goes to the point where they were muting his craziness. It's just, everything about this is so pitch perfect, and you are just lost in, this is where your movie, where you can really feel the cobwebs, the dark shadows, the gothicness, and It's just, yeah, it just, it's so creepy and so wonderful.
Oh, absolutely. Most definitely agree with you 100%.
Yeah. Yes, and with that, except for, like, Victor Kerr trying to look for another drink at the wedding he's annoyed that he has to pay for. just the fact that he's getting annoyed, he wants to sort of break up the marriage because he doesn't want to pay for it. Then he's just, like, happy the wedding's there because he gets a drink. It's just, he's just that perfect comic character in Feet. We just wanted to get that in before we go into a absolutely bonkers movie. A movie I used to watch a lot as a kid. And never realized what this movie was actually doing. We're going to go into Weird Science from 1985. Now, we're sitting down. It's about to start showing. What is your first trailer for Weird Science?
My first trailer for Weird Science was Once Bitten with Jim Carrey and Lauren Hutton.
Mark Kendall's a regular guy.
Get me out of here!
With normal problems.
I want to, but I want it to be special.
But Mark's just discovered...
Hello, tall, dark, and handsome.
That his one-night stand...
I haven't had anything this pure since the Vienna Boys Choir hit town.
...has been around for centuries.
I'm 390 years old.
400 if you're a day.
Mark Kendall is necking...
Finally happened.
...with a vampire.
Did I enjoy it?
A kind of vampire teen boner comedy from the 80s. The first time I ever seen this was my mother introduced me to this movie because actually she enjoyed it. And it's like my mother has a weird taste in movies, you know, like... Like, you see her, and you're like, she likes that movie? I'm like, oh, she loves that movie. but, like, yeah, I thought it was fitting, you know, being that we're kind of going into... the Weird Science is kind of sort of like a teenage Frankenstein kind of story. So, like, I keep up, like, the monster aspect. And, like, yeah, let's go with a, like, teenage vampire story. And, Once Bitten was the one that stuck out to me the most. So that's why I chose Once Bitten. It's a cute little comedy. It's not one of the greatest. Jim Carrey, very early in his career, very restrained before, you know, the rubber face as we get to know him throughout the remainder of his career. But it's a neat little comedy.
Yeah, I didn't get to watch this, even though it's on streaming. But I did watch the trailer, and I was actually kind of surprised about how Jim restrained he was. And then I went, oh, wait, yeah, this is before Ace Ventura. Of course, he's not quite going to be able to go loose. But it looks like a whole fun and a perfect, perfect trailer for what we're about to get into.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
I decided to go for the slightly different route. Just because these are two little mad scientists that we're about to be dealing with in Weird Science, I decided to go with a 1981 horror movie, Evil Speak with Clint Howard, because if the boys are creating a woman out of a computer, well, you can also summon the devil.
Everyone's known a boy like Stanley Coopersmith.
Evil Speak.
He's the kid everyone used to pick on.
Screwed up for the last time, Cooper Dick.
Evil Speak.
You see, everyone thought Stanley was a joke. An outcast with no one to turn to.
You guys broke my catapult. You're gonna pay for that.
No one except man's most advanced machine. Stanley used the power of man to call on the powers of evil.
So this is gonna be my trailer. It's a really weird movie. I mean, this is a movie where it's at 11, but Clint Howard is taking it to 13. It's a hard movie to describe unless you've actually seen it, but it's insane.
Yeah. My mother actually hates this movie. Not because she thinks it's bad, because she saw it as when she was younger, and she was absolutely horrified by it. Like, I don't know. I think it's just weird, bonkers horror film, and it's fun, but... My mother's absolutely terrified. I can't even mention this movie around her. I gotta say, hey, mother, I'm watching Evil Speak. No, please, no. I don't even want to think about that movie. Leave me alone.
Maybe it's because all kind of computers back in 1982 came pre-programmed with Cyrillic, whatever the language it comes up with. I can kind of see that, because it would have been kind of this crazy idea that there would be evil in this kind of household kind of thing, but I love that. I don't think if I mention Evil Speak to My Mother or even Once Bitten, she'll just look at me and go, what is that?
Right.
What is your second trailer?
Like I said, keeping with the monster aspect, I decided to go with Teen Wolf.
Yes. Starring,
Michael J. Fox. Now,
for Michael J. Fox, life hasn't been easy.
I'm going through changes.
His voice is changing.
Give me a keg of beer.
Is there anything wrong with me?
He's got hair on his chest. He stopped being a boy.
What do you think about to get worked up?
At last, he's become...
Scott? Scott Howard? This is your father speaking. Now open this door right this minute.
A wolf.
An explanation is probably long overdue.
Dad, an explanation? Look at me. Look at you.
This is one of my all-time favorites. I think I love this one as much as I love Weird Science. I grew up watching this. I probably watched this more than Back to the Future because I had access to it. I didn't have access to a Back to the Future. My father actually taped over Back to the Future with high spirits, which I'm still mad about. It's like 30 something years later, I'm still upset about, and I still hate high spirits to this day because of that. But
that is horrific.
Yeah. So I did have Teen Wolf on video, so I watched Teen Wolf a lot, and I still love it to this day. I did a rewatch of it maybe a year ago or two, and I still love it. I still think it's there's a little couple moments in there that's like that hasn't aged well. But what 80s movie has it, you know, has aged well, if you will. But the Teen Wolf, I still think it's great for the most part, and I love it.
No, I haven't seen Teen Wolf in a while, but I know this is one I used to watch a lot as a kid because it was always on TV, and I think I may have actually have seen this more than Back to the Future as well, purely just because I was like, oh, Teen Wolf is on again. Cool. But yeah, I just remember it being this kind of really sense of bat crazy kind of fun. But yeah, I need to watch this movie again just because I haven't seen it for absolutely ages. And it's kind of just another 1985 special that we'll be getting into, just sort of looking at going, oh wow, a lot of movies really came out in 1985 that I just watched on repeat. just constantly, including Weird Science. Now I'm going into a movie that did not play on repeat. I don't think anywhere in Australia or NZ. It's the only movie I saw. I only managed to track down a couple of years ago. It is very much. I'm going more in the inappropriate relationship kind of thing. A little exploitation movie from 1984. They're Playing with Fire with Sybil Danning.
What do you do when the only sound is the beat of your heart? Stay, but love's taking you higher, higher, higher. Oh, you're playing with fire.
Playboy sensation Sybil Danning and Eric Brown, the star of Private Lessons. Just when they thought they had it made, someone starts playing with their lives.
This movie is the definition of insane. It sort of starts off as this kind of a sex comedy with a teacher and a student, and then just takes a big turn into something completely different. This movie has like five movies going on, and none of them fit together, but oh my, it's just an insane ride.
Wow. That's one I haven't seen either, but sounds interesting. I got to check it out one day.
It really is. You think you're getting into one movie and you think you know what it is, and then I'm not going to even sort of go exactly where it goes, but it is a trip.
Nice.
And with that, we will be getting into the 1985, Weird Science.
You know, it's not a bad idea.
What?
Making a girl. Actually making a girl.
This is Wyatt and Gary.
I give her warm, digits mammary glands.
Something's about to change their world. Something out of this world.
She's alive! Alive!
What would you little maniacs like to do first?
It's all in the name of science. Weird Science.
If you want to be a party animal, you have to learn to live in the jungle.
Not us. Not here. No way.
She is turning their lives.
Trust me for once, will you?
What is going on?
Harry, I don't know.
I don't know.
Their minds.
Now, I have a huge history with this. Well, not a huge history, but I do have a big history with weird science. I'm guessing you have a similar one back in the 80s?
Yes, yes, yes. We had this one on video. This was one that stayed on repeat in my house, as well as a host of other John Hughes movies. I mean, you know, this and 16 Candles and The Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller. Like, yeah. These were the ones that we repeated. I think Weird Science was probably the one we watched the most. Maybe it's 16 Candles we watched the most, but Weird Science was right behind it. I really loved this movie as a kid, and I did a rewatch of it. I bought the Arrow Steelbook Blu-ray of it. I want to say 2 years ago.
Oh wow!
And, I think that was when they released the steelbook, and I did a rewatch of it, and it was like, like, it still makes me laugh. Like, it's still like all the right moments. It still makes me laugh. I really, really do love this movie.
I know it definitely still made me laugh, even though I was cringing as much as I was laughing. This is definitely the John Hughes movie I watched the most as a kid. I think Uncle Buck was definitely up there, and 16 Candles. And so I've always had this love this movie, because I used to watch it. We didn't have the video, but I think it just almost, there was a stage where it got rented almost every week. Like, whenever Dad would go to the video store, he would just grab that because he knew I would sit down and just watch it a couple of times. So, I think there was a time where I could almost run the dialogue off by heart. And then I sort of watched it a few years ago and went, oh, is that what was happening a lot? I didn't realize half of the jokes in this movie. And then rewatching it, it still made me laugh. Even the stuff I kind of felt I shouldn't have been laughing at, especially when Anthony Michael Hall pretending he's a black man. I was just like, really?
Yeah, that scene is still funny. That's probably the my favorite scene in the movie. And the whole what they call a black scent, the black accent,
yes,
that he
that's
does.
The word I was, yeah.
Yeah, it's still funny though. Like, I still laugh at it because I see, like, here's the thing with John Hughes movies. Like, John Hughes is a fantastic writer, director when it came to teen movies, but he could also be very frustrating at times, like, especially when you go back and look at some of his movies and, like, some of the choices he made, like 16 Candles, as much as I love it, like, there's so many frustrating moments, like the character of Long Duk Dong is incredibly insensitive and frustrating character. But, you know, those were the times, and, like, you know, they did stuff like that back in those days, you know, had those characters because, you know, it's all funny and all that stuff. But, you know, you're trying to make a sincere teen movie that represents these characters authentically, and then you have this, like, kind of stereotypical Asian character over there, kind of like mutes the whole, like, aesthetic or, like, feeling, if you will, like, you know, nowadays. But I still enjoy the film. And like Breakfast Club, he you know, that Breakfast Club is the most frustrating one because he gets it right almost, like, almost, he almost sticks the landing, and then he blows it when he has Molly Ringwald's character, Claire, get with Bender.
Yes.
Like, and it's so frustrating because, you know, in real life that would never happen because Bender is an awful person. Like they make you understand why he's awful, and I get it, and, you know, I appreciate that, like, giving him, like, backstory and fully fleshed out character, but he's still a prick to Claire. Like, he even basically sexually assaults her when he tries to shove his face in between her legs while he's under the table.
Yes.
And, like, you know, like, dude, she could have you fucking arrested for that, dude. That's disgusting. And and then all of a sudden at the end, like, they just hook up, and then it's like, I don't buy that one bit. I don't buy her getting with him. And Molly Ringwald didn't buy, she did a rewatch with her daughter, and she was like, yeah, no, I don't buy that.
She's like, I know, I would never even pick it.
Right, it would never.
She was like, no.
Yeah, you would never. And it's an awful, awful, awful thing. But with Weird Science, it's like the one he gets away with, like, you know, those kind of things, because it's such a silly premise, you know?
Yes.
You can get away with all that stuff because it's literally about two kids who create a woman with a computer. out of thin air.
It really is, and I forgot how much of a thin air kind of thing it was, because everything in the movie I thought happened later in the movie for some reason. All my sort of timelines, I'm like, oh shit, 10 minutes in, they've just created Lisa. Oh, now we're at the party. And it's, yeah, I thought that was kind of way later in the movie, but it sort of happens kind of in the middle. It starts the second act. And I think I love the point you sort of make about how he's able to create these very sincere, Hughes was able to create these very sincere characters. And then just have kind of these weird kind of things that, because he was always one of those writers who was able to throw things at the wall to see what stuck. And sometimes it's cars, trains, and automobiles when it's everything pretty much just works. And then sometimes it is Pretty in Pink when you're watching it going, stop calling her. Please just stop it, Ducky. You can't call her 16 times in an hour. And it's, but I think he was, he had a very specific sensibility. He was very, at the times, the slobs versus snobs, which he loved and would, you see it in all his movies. And I think he was a complicated writer. I mean, I do love the, I can't remember which magazine it was for, the piece that Molly Ringwald, wrote about him when she was sort of saying, they had a complicated relationship because she was a teenager and he did in fact work with teenagers. He had this sort of amazing sensibility and was able to get these amazing performances out of Molly and Anthony Michael Hall. And, but she sort of said, yeah, I didn't understand what kind of the relationship he wanted to have. It wasn't sexual, but he wanted something else that I was never able to give him. And it's such this amazing kind of piece that I think kind of describes all his movies. And you can't help fall in love with these characters, and then he'll do something like, I kind of do love the fact that Anthony Michael Hall keeps that accent up for like three scenes. Like he just, keeps going with it. And it is kind of this amazing, and then you'll see something and then you'll get the moment with Gary, Anthony Michael Hall's parents. And it's just this amazing running joke of his dad just not knowing who their son is and his mother kid going, remember we have a son. So there's so many weird little bits and skits in this movie that I just, that are so, so great. And then, and I think it just sort of speaks to the kind of writer that John Hughes was, is that he was a very messy writer. And I kind of love that about him, even though sometimes I'm like, did we really need that moment in that? But other times I'm like, oh, yeah, please turn Bill Paxton into whatever snot thing you've created.
He ends up looking like a Goomba from Super Mario with hands. like you said, Hughes was a smart writer, but sometimes like he had like those moments, like he just couldn't help but put like sophomore moments in his movies, you know, which completely belittles the entire feel. Like you said, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles gets it right in a sense, like especially for adults, you know, because it's an adult feature. And I would say She's Having a Baby as well. Like the teenagers, like he knows teenagers, and then like, you know, he will show like you feel like he gets them, and then like you said, he'll have a moment where it's like, do you really get them? Because this feels I don't buy that this would work in real life situation. But like that's why I said like Weird Science, you kind of got to look past that, because it's all silly, you know. It's such a silly movie that you kind of really not even looking for that in this movie, like that you were looking for like Breakfast Club or some kind of Wonderful, those truths, because it's like you got half the cast of the Road Warrior in the middle of the living room in like the second act. You know, like who's gonna take this seriously, you know? So like it's almost like the opposite of usually his movies, like where it's like he'll have like this sincere movie with silly moments, and this one is a silly movie with sincere moments, you know?
Absolutely, because you do get these very amazingly beautiful, sincere moments, especially between Gary and Wyatt near the end, when they sort of tell each other that they're both in love, and then sort of Gary goes, yeah, isn't it great? And it's just this really kind of amazing moment, especially when they sort of realize that, yeah, they're best friends, but their friendship isn't going to take all over their lives like it had done. They're going to go out and date girls and kind of live their own lives. And it's this great kind of almost like super bad moment when you get those two at the end, Jonah Hill, kind of hugging and just going, yeah, love you, bro, even though they know that the next year they're going to go out into different colleges. Right. It's that same kind of moment. And it is this, yeah, you're right. There are some amazingly sweet moments in this movie, but and I want to go to touch the point of like, yes, John Hughes got teenagers and then sometimes he didn't, because I think he liked to sort of put all teenagers into one box and it didn't always work for the characters. But this is two boys who are hanging out on a Saturday night. They decide to see if they can create a woman in a computer and they're wearing bras on their head. It's like, yes, this is how I imagine two 15-year-old boys on Friday night. This is exactly what they would do because it is dumb and it is ridiculous, but it makes sense to them. And yes, and then Kelly LeBrock appears, who is, oh, I forgot how goddamn beautiful she is, and actually really funny. Like, I was kind of surprised. I forgot how actual funny she is in this movie.
Yeah, no, she's absolutely a revelation in the film. Not just, you know, like you said, she's just absolutely gorgeous woman. But she is great. Like, has great comedic timing. Like, the scene with Gary's parents and when she's telling off his dad, like, don't push me around, I'll kick your ass. You know, like, and she's just great. Like, she's just absolutely just wonderful throughout this whole movie. You know, I even love like sweet, like that final scene between her and Gary and Wyatt.
Yeah,
it's still a tearjerker moment. And, you know, just, and it shows just how talented a performer she is. You know, like, people would look at her and like, oh yeah, like, you know, good looks. You know, like, nah, she's great. Like, around that, like, you know, she's not just looks, you know, she's an incredibly performer all around. You know, she can make you laugh, she can make you cry, she's wonderful, just completely wonderful in the film.
She is. And I love how, even though essentially the boys created her and she keeps sort of, there's these very weird conversations about, you know, teenage boys owning this woman, she does actually have quite a bit of agency because she's kind of directing and telling them kind of what to do. And yes, a lot of it kind of seems inappropriate when you're going, really? But at the same time, she's basically trying to get them to grow up and get them not to start perving at women who are doing gymnastics in the beginning, but to actually go out and talk to them.
Right.
With the two girls they end up dating, it's kind of this weird thing of, yeah, you can just talk to a girl. It's okay. They'll talk back. They're people. And I think you really get the sense from most, because most in comedies, the girls that they start dating don't usually have personalities. And these two kind of do. And I think it's because, I don't know, maybe I just was reading into it, but Kelly LeBrock has so much agency. She's the one who's kind of controlling all the action. And she's kind of this bizarre little bat-crazed genie almost. Who can, right. I don't understand what her powers are, but they're amazing. But she's kind of the driving force of the movie to actually get things going. I think I've muddled that up, but yeah, that's essentially what I'm saying.
No. She wants them to become men, you know, yes. Because they're very much boys, you know. Mm. Like, obviously, this is a boy's idea coming up with, you know, inventing a woman on their computer, and like, you know, the idea of owning her is like sexual, but like, you know, she's here. Okay, I'm here. Like, what are you guys gonna do with me? And they're terrified of her. You know, they, when they take the shower, they still got their jeans on.
Yes.
You know, and she's like, I see what I got to do here. Like, you know, they invent her a slave. Like, but she eventually becomes like a mentor to them, and like she wants them like yeah, like just like you said, like, you know, go talk to her. Like, you know, if you're not, I'm gonna make you. And like, I'm not gonna make you like, you know, really pursue these women, you know, these girls, but I'm gonna make you become men. And like, you know, with the confrontation with my man Vernon Wells, that comes in with the motorcycles, and like, you know, they really have to grow up, you know, to go from being 15-year-old boys wearing bras on their heads at the beginning of the movie to where they're actually defending a house full of people from these biker mutants, you know. but like it's like says, like I was saying, that those sincere moments where it's like, you know, and after they've defended the house and they sent them on their way and they protected these people, and she was like, those are my boys, you know. And she's like, you know, now they went and, you know, they've won these girls over, and like, she's like, my job is done, you know, like, now I'm happy with the position they are. Like, you know, if this is a good start, you know what I'm saying? It's yes. not, it's not like, you know, they're content now, but like, it's a good start way to walk a path where they could become good individual men, you know? And that's her job. And so that's why she's like, okay, I'm out of here, you know, bye guys. And, you know, it's a very touching moment. It's just a nice little, like, you know, throughout this whole silly movie, like, it's a nice little arc for these characters that is what I really enjoy.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Cause I know, Kelly LeBrock has described her role as Mary Poppins with boobs. She's not exactly wrong. I mean, she is playing the, sex pot kind of element to 11, which is kind of great because you're right. This is a young boy's definition of one, how you get a girlfriend, how, that she is yours. And the whole process of the movie is like going, even though she keeps saying, yeah, I will do anything for them. They made me, they own me. But at the same time, she keeps pushing them away. She keeps going, no, no, be men. Go up, grow up, go talk to a girl, actually get to know her. Right. And it's kind of, they have to kind of change their perception of, from being a boy to a man. And I don't know if it's exactly as successful as I would like it to be, but I accept this is how John Hughes did it, and I still think it's really well done. Even though this is a movie I don't think he particularly wanted to do, I know he really wanted to do Breakfast Club. And so I think Universal sort of said, okay, if you make Weird Science, then you can go make Breakfast Club. And obviously Breakfast Club is Breakfast Club. But it's just this kind of, but still, he still manages to put these little amazing little moments in there of just absolute almost surreal absurdity, and then these kind of very sweet moments. I love the moment where she's saying goodbye to them. I think it's a very sincere moment, and then you just get these amazing, like, almost second, I'm just pulling out Second City just because it's this movie, even though it's not Chicago, god damn it, this movie's going to be Chicago. And just, I love the whole poster. Hey, you're in Chicago. I'm like, yes, I know. I'm in a John Hughes movie. that's kind of a given. And it's just this kind of, it's so him. He made this movie his own, and no one else's. And so even though sometimes I get a bit cringy on it, I take it as, yeah, I'm watching a John Hughes movie. This is kind of what it is. And I kind of embrace all of it because I have to get the stuff to get the amazing stuff, and I love the amazing stuff in this movie, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. Like, it makes absolutely perfect sense. I get what you're saying. The I mean, I don't think there's as many cringy moments. They're definitely there. One character I wanted to talk about is Chet, the character of Chet, played by the late great Bill Paxton.
Yes,
and that is a loss that I will feel forever. I love Bill Paxton as an actor.
Yeah.
He was an actor who remained constant in my movie going, my movie viewing life, and his losses will be forever felt and by me. But we're here to celebrate him as a performer, and he is absolutely just phenomenal in this film. I cannot stop laughing every time he's on screen. Ugh. Like, just his just his first scene, you stupid one. You know, he's absolutely just incredible and in, throughout this movie, and the way he
hilarious. You're right. Every time he's on screen, I just can't stop laughing at him. Just his hair, just the way his big eyes, the way he just, yeah, but what? And then how Wyatt's like, okay, how much this time? How much do I? And just like, you just love the notion of that fact that he keeps extorting money out of his little brother.
I like the, you said his haircut. It reminded me of the moment where Wyatt is carrying Gary off, and Gary's still drunk. He goes, he's an asshole. Anybody with a haircut like that, you know he an asshole. He's great. Like, and I remember Bill Paxton saying that, like, when Chet says to them, how about a nice greasy pork chop sandwich served in a dirty ashtray? he related that that was something his father used to say to him. Like, he would go out drinking with his boys and come back just drunk, and that was something his father would say to him, you know. so I like that he added that into the character and all that stuff. But he does have a cringy moment, and it's a moment that, like, really, like, just, oh my god. And this is where he comes and he sees the house wrecked after the party. Yeah. And Gary sleeping in the bed with Deb, played by Suzanne Snyder.
Yes.
And he points a gun at them.
Yes.
And it's like, and not only does he shove the gun in her face, but he hits both of them over the head with it. And it's like, yeah, I know this is supposed to be funny, but, like, dude, you should be in jail, because that is assault with a deadly weapon.
Like, it really is. I was kind of just giggling, because his first reaction is, when he sees the house, is to grab a gun. And one, I think that sort of speaks to the character he's playing. But then when you sort of when he wakes up, those two, and they've just got a shotgun in the face, and they don't, and you can tell they're like, what do we do? And it's, yeah, you're right. That is assault with a deadly weapon. And it is just kind of one of those moments of, oh, now you might be taking it a little bit too far. You might deserve to be turned into a sponge at the end. And it's, but you're right. Every single time he's on screen, he's just so funny. Bilbo hasn't always had this energy. And then you had a kind of fitted in, like, I'm blanking the vampire move he made with Catherine Bigelow.
Near Dark.
Near Dark, yes. His character in Near Dark is bonkers and over the top, but it's done in this perfect way that fits within the movie, because he knows he can play off every other character, like Lance Henriksen's being ultra serious, so he knows he can bounce it off. And he knows how to deal with it in this movie as well, almost, it feels like instinctively, I can go big because I know I can bounce off these two kids. And Anthony Michael Hall always had the best comic timing. So when he's doing all that kind of stuff, you know, if he has a haircut like that, he's an arsehole. And then when he starts doing the lip thing, it goes on forever. I love it so much. He's just playing with his lips. And Bill Paxton's just getting angrier and angrier. And it's kind of, yeah, he always knew instinctively what pitch to go to so he could play off with the other people in the room. And his scenes are some of the best because of that reason. And though the cast in this movie, just when you look back, you're like, holy crap, this is an amazing cast. I mean, Robert Downey Jr. is sort of playing a one-note role, but he's freaking fantastic in it.
Yeah. Him and his character's best friend, Max, yes, played by Robert Russler.
Yes.
You can see, like, they work well off each other, too. Like, if you know that they were not only friends in the movie, but they're friends in real life to this day. Robert Downey Jr. is the godfather to Robert Russler's son.
That's so cool.
And they still hang out to this day. They're still friends to this day. Both of them are great. Downey Jr. and Robert Russler. They're supposed to be like the weenie like they're supposed to be like the preppy douchebag asshole versions of Gary and Wyatt. Like, you know, they're supposed to be like in the world they're the cool kids, but, like, you know they're really just weenies, you know, because
exactly
they're so much assholes. And it's like, you love it when they actually are around cool people, like in the party, like, you know, they're their friends, but then you have like the people from the bar.
Yes.
That's and he tells them, like, why don't you just give me the whole bottle? I tell you what, why don't you bend over and I'll shove it straight up your ass? You know? And then you realize, yeah, they're fucking dweebs. They're like, they're weenies. Like, they suck, you know. and they play that role great. Like, you know, they're really fantastic. They really play off each other well. Like, when they pour the slushy on their heads. And, like, the girls are like, oh, we're going to dump them. And you see them in the background fucking around.
Yes.
Like, yeah, they're great.
I know. And the thing is about that sort of scene is I can kind of see why those girls start dating them in the beginning. Because they give amazing puppy dog eye. Like, we're going to dump them. You see them fucking around in the background. And then they'll turn and they just sort of stand there contrite looking at them with this amazing puppy dog expression on both of them. And if I was a 15-year-old girl, go, oh, but look at them. They're so puppy dog and sweet. And even though I know they're assholes, and you're right, they've got their own little universe going on that you don't necessarily get privy to what they're actually doing in the day to day. But yeah, they are kind of this other, they are Gary and Wyatt if they actually went out more and went to parties, but they're just, they would be just as douchey. And
yeah,
I don't know, they're just so funny, especially when the party's being invaded by the bikers and they're sort of hiding behind the bar and they're like, we should go do something. Nah, and they go hide behind the bar again.
Yeah, and then you never see them again. We never see them again.
It's,
yeah, for what I know, they're probably still there to this day.
They're just quietly just drinking booze, just like, no, it's, we're staying here. It's turning into a parasite situation. We're just here.
Are they gone yet? Are they gone yet? Oh, no, we'll stay here. We'll stay here. We'll it's stay all here. Good.
It's fine. it's just every kind of, the casting is done so well that everyone kind of gets these fleshed out little things. Like, oh my God, Gary's parents. I should actually look up the guy who plays his dad because I have seen him before and he's so great. Like, they're these typical kind of 80s parents who are kind of shocked that their son is 16 and maybe, you know, horny or everything like that. And how Gary is just like, going, oh, no, she's a student. She's an exchange student. And Lisa's just on the thing, drinking, cracking open a beer going, do I look like I'm a high school student?
Right. Totally. Britt Leach is his name.
Yes.
The actor who plays Al Wallace, Gary's dad.
Yeah. Yeah. And he just, it's so great. Just the angrier and angrier he gets. And then it just turns into this really kind of weird skit of like, Lisa's like, oh no, they're not going to remember a thing. And then of course he just does not remember he has a son at all. And then they just keep going back to that joke and I love it so much.
I love that. What do you think was wrong with Gary tonight? Gary?
Gary.
Who the hell is Gary?
And then through the night, you just keep going back to them. She's showing a photo of him going, remember, he's our son.
Yeah. I don't know what the hell you're doing. I want you to stop. Shut the hell up.
And then Gary drives past them really fast in a Ferrari. And they're just like, was that Gary? Who's that asshole? It's just like... I don't know. It's just some of the funniest bits in the movie, and it's just this guy just like, I don't know. It's just done so well. It's just kind of goes back to that chaos that Lisa's kind of creating and kind of going further than maybe she planned or something, but it just adds to these brilliant moments like, oh my God, Wyatt's grandparents. Oh, there's nothing more important to a young boy than his grandparents. It's just...
Yeah, I love that. When Chet opens the door, hi, Granny. Hi, Grampy. He just calls. He's like, were those my grandparents? What the hell are they doing in there? Are they dead?
And just the look on her face when she's in the pantry is just the, like, frozen is the best kind of expression on her face.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just, yeah, that's the stuff I love. It's not necessarily sort of the main plot. It's just these little things on the sides, like the Bill Paxton, the Robert Downey Jr. You know, nothing is more important to a young boy than his grandparents. It's, oh my God, just imagine if, I mean, some families are really, really close, but if my grandparents are just turning up and saying hello, actually, my Nana was a massive drinker. She should be just see the party, just go, yeah, where's my drink? It's a slightly different relationship, but I love that line so much. It's just such huge comic sensibility, and it's, yeah.
Yeah, most definitely.
Also, did you notice, you see it a couple of times during the party, there's a family portrait on the stairs and someone's drawn Hitler mustaches on all the family members.
Yes.
I just love it how it's always in the background. Hughes keeps going back to it, but it's never ever pointed out.
Right. I think it's just like, let me see how many people notice.
Yeah. And the scene in the bathroom when Wyatt and Gary won't leave.
Oh, yeah. No, that's one of my, if not my favorite moment, after Wyatt takes a shit in the bathroom and the girls show up. And light a match or something. Light a fire. I don't know. And then when Gary opens the door to talk to the girls, it's what are you guys doing in here? Gary was just in here taking a shit. he shuts the door so fast and slaps the shit out of him.
And then you just constantly see the match or the flame just kind of going across the door. It's just to remind you.
Right, right. I just love the cut to Gary slapping. But that makes me laugh.
No, it's so great. The whole scene is just timed so perfectly. One, they're comfortable enough to do that in front of each other, which I always love. It's like, yep, yeah, I guess that's true friendship when you don't have to leave the room. And two, it's just that, yeah, they're just trying to deal with so much. It's this kind of perfect fast moment. And yeah, you do get these the moments of cut to the slap, the shutting the door really, really quickly, then opening it again. And then the girls go, oh, can we? Like, can you leave? Will we freshen up? So they go into the shower. It's
oh, yeah.
It's just this kind of amazingly perfect moment of them kind of trying to decide, okay, we're going to talk to them. Yeah, it's going to be fine. And then opening it up, it's not them. It's two other girls. But it's just this, I don't know, the comic timing on that scene is just so perfect. You almost want to rewind it and watch it again because it really showcases how good and Anthony Michael Hall really well, especially at comic timing at such a young age, because him and Leon Mitchell Smith were both teenagers. I mean, he was Mitchell Smith was 14. Anthony Michael Hall would have been what, 15, 16 at the time?
Yeah, about yeah.
Yeah. And just to see his comic timing in that, and then to go on and watch Breakfast Club and to realize, oh, he also had the emotional range to be able to go with it as well is kind of, you forget how talented that kid was, and I kind of wish he was able to do more as an adult.
Yeah, yeah, most definitely. I think he teaches now, from what I heard.
Yeah.
I know, like, he disappeared for a while.
Mm.
Like, I guess wanted to have a normal life, but, like, he's recently resurfaced and, like, started doing conventions and stuff, and I know they had, like, a reunion between the three of them. With Anthony Michael Hall and Kelly LeBrock. There's a picture circulating all of the three of them all together again. And it was great. It brought me so much joy to see that. Like, the three of them together again. So, but yeah. He really was talented. And he played off of Anthony Michael Hall well. Because he's basically the straight man to Anthony Michael Hall.
Yes. Yeah. And I always think the straight man has a bigger job because you have to kind of be the straight man. And it's almost the harder job because Anthony Michael Hall is just kind of being goofy and being kind of loose. And he's kind of the uptight one. And I keep forgetting how young he was until I heard him get really angry and start shouting. I'm like, what is wrong with your voice? Oh, that's because you're 14 and your voice still hasn't broken in yet. Ah, got it. That's exactly how a 14-year-old, and I think that John Hughes kept working with teenagers is because they kind of gave an authenticity to what they were doing. I mean, when you watch Breakfast Club with Molly and Anthony, everyone else is adults in that movie, but they're teenagers, and they can really kind of get across that, you know, Molly Ringwald is very selfish and shallow at the beginning because she's a 16-year-old girl, and she kind of innately knows how to act, and that shy kind of teenager that Anthony Michael Hall plays is, again, they kind of get it, and he knew how to bring those performances out of them, and he does it with Weird Science as well with those two kids, and it's kind of amazing to watch them kind of almost, yeah, you watch them grow from boys to men on screen, and it is a special thing to watch.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Over the course of a weekend, because this movie takes place over the course of a weekend. So they go from boys to men fairly quickly, you know.
Yeah, it's like the scene where it's like, oh, he shouldn't be driving. Yeah, he doesn't have his driver's license. And they're just driving like it's no big thing at the end. So I think that was just like this really interesting.
Yeah, most definitely. Driving sports cars.
Yes. It's like, how fast are you going? Oh, 135. It's like, what? It's they never quite lose that kind of boyish kind of thing, especially sort of at the end. You still got the sense of it, but it's I don't know. There's just the good moments for me outweigh kind of the stuff I wish wasn't exactly in there. But at the same time, it was 1985, and it's John Hughes, and he's kind of Hughes. And I still think he's kind of trying to work out stuff in his movies, like a lot of directors doing, and he's just doing that exact same thing, like. I am not entirely sure he ever liked being a grown-up. Even when he was more adult movies, you can kind of see the regression of can I just be a kid? Can I just do these kind of things? Even though he had amazing pathos to him, that movie with Steve Martin and John Candy, losing my words again. And then you sort of watch him do these amazingly funny bits. And I don't know, he was one of those, there's a reason why he's one of those directors that define the mid 80s.
Yeah, most definitely. It's funny enough you say that, he just wants to regress to being a kid, because he actually, you know, he went from teenagers to little kids in the 90s, where he was doing like stuff like Home Alone and Dennis the Menace and Baby's Day Out.
Yes.
Like, he was right about little kids. So like, yeah, you definitely got a point there.
Oh, I forgot he did Dennis the Menace. Yes, you're right. They are kids being kids. I mean, yes, Kevin McAllister definitely has some issues he needs to work out, because the fact that he keeps torturing people. But it's...
Oh, yeah, Kevin's a sociopath.
He totally is. I think he's such a fascinating writer-director, because he obviously wrote what was interesting him, and he keeps going back to these kind of themes of always sort of going home, family, being a kid. And he was almost always at his best when he is writing about teenagers and kids, because he had this way of just kind of being able to make a stereotype but yet expand it. And he does it in Weird Science. He does it in, of course, going back to Breakfast Club again. And he could get those lines absolutely perfectly. And he was able also let his characters kind of his actors improv. So if they had a line, he wasn't ever really that precious about his lines being read the way he wanted them to be read.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, so they could sort of bring their kind of things to it. And yeah, just watching Anthony Michael Hall just kind of go nuts and just improv and that was is kind of special to watch, because he's just going for it, and I love it.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, Hughes is a... I think he's an incredible writer and filmmaker. That's why it's all the more frustrating when he has these moments where it's just like you were mentioning Pretty in Pink, you know, and Ducky just being insufferable. And, you know, and it's like, you know, the fella, you can't, just because you're this woman's friend, she doesn't owe you anything, you know, and that's the confusion. Ultimately, you know, he lets that go so she can be who she wants to be, which is the character of Blaine, played by Andrew McCarthy. Mm. And then, like, he eventually, you know, picks up somebody at the end. And, you know, you feel like it really worked out that way, you know. And then, but to find out that's not the ending he wanted, and he hated that he had to change it, because test audiences was like, no, like, she should be with Blaine, not Ducky.
Mm.
He wanted her to end up with Ducky.
Yes.
You know, so that was him rewarding that kind of behavior. And it's like, oh, John, like, you had it, like, you know. And then it frustrated him enough that he basically went and did another version of that, Some Kind of Wonderful. And I think it works as Some Kind of Wonderful, because, you know, the characters in that, the way they're portrayed, you know, it's the guy that's just naive about, you know, the girl that likes him. And, you know, she's basically trying to say, like, you know, we're better together, you know, because this is who you are, you know, because he's basically trying to step out and try to be something that he's eventually not. And he's right per se, you know, because his father wants him to be this, you know, this guy and all that stuff. But he really wants to be his own man. But he's still naive enough that he doesn't notice that this girl is better for him than the girl he wants, who's kind of out of his league.
Yes.
And he's kind of trying to pretend something that he's not in order to impress her. And that works. And so I appreciate Some Kind of Wonderful. But, like, him trying to do it in Pretty in Pink, it absolutely did not work right now. And the fact that he was upset enough that they made him change the ending, and then he wanted Molly Ringwald to be in Some Kind of Wonderful, which she was like, I kind of want to do that. I kind of want to stop doing teenage roles. And then that ended their working relationship, because he was so mad that she didn't want to do Some Kind of Wonderful.
Mm.
And it's just, it's like, you know, it kind of frustrates me. Like, he also never hired Bill Paxton again because Bill Paxton didn't want to play the parking attendant in Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
He offered him
one of the parking attendants, and Bill Paxton was like, I think Bill Paxton was doing Aliens at the time, and this would have been between Aliens and Near Dark, and he was probably looking for more bigger roles, which is understandable as you're trying to build up your filmography. And he said that Bill Paxton had said later on that he wished he had done that role because John Hughes never offered him a role again in one of his movies. And it's like the fact that you have to take a role you don't want just to appease a filmmaker is just the most frustrating thing. And like I said, I think he's a brilliant writer, director, but like stuff like that ultimately just kind of bums me out to hear, because I'm less like, damn, dude, really? Was it that serious?
Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, I mean, his relationship with his actors is always fascinating because, especially with Molly, because I think he wanted her to stay a teenager and she's growing up and going, well, no, I'm not going to play a 16-year-old when I'm not now. It's kind of this very, and I think you can kind of see it in his writing that he is a very complex guy who had some bad tendencies. And you can kind of see him like a lot of artists working through it. And yeah, he doesn't sound like always the easiest guy to get along with, because you always have to be on his terms. And of course, the more movies he made, the more allowances people probably made for that. And I understand why Bill Paxton didn't want to take that role in Ferris. He was doing Aliens and Near Dark, and he's actually able to stretch his acting kind of thing and just sort of say, well, no, but then realize, oh, I've burnt a bridge here. And it's, yeah, I find him absolutely fascinating because I think he was such a strong writer, but you can kind of see the demons and the angels every single time he writes. And I think it makes him a better filmmaker because you can kind of see that. And yes, you can kind of look at Pretty in Pink and go, John, no, don't. Okay, one, she's breaking up with Blaine in 2 weeks, which is great because she's going to go to New York and do her own thing. Even though I think, and she would definitely not end up with Ducky. So it's kind of, but you can kind of see him trying to work out that kind of thing and going, and I think he always was that kid who kind of maybe saw himself as an Anthony Michael Hall kind of thing when the roles that he played, but he kind of wanted to be the cool kid. And you can kind of see that through all of his work. And even when he was the cool kid, because he's freaking John Hughes, you still see that those insecurities. And the stories with Bill Paxton and Molly, I think, just really speak true to that. And which is why I think, again, he is the filmmaker that he is, and why his movies, you can look deeper into his movies and sort of come up with that. And yes, some of them do make me uncomfortable because of those reasons. But at the same time, it's like, well, this is who this guy was. You can see all those insecurities all throughout his movies, and even into something as dopey and as, oh, okay, I'm going to make this so I can make the movie I actually want to make. You can still see it in Weird Science, because that's just the kind of filmmaker he was. He put everything just out there.
Yeah, most definitely. Absolutely agree.
Anything else you want to say about Weird Science, or
I think we covered everything.
I think
I think we put everything on the table that we could about this movie. And
it was such a pleasure to talk to you. You were as intelligent and insightful and funny as I thought you would be. And this was likewise, so great.
likewise, absolutely. I had a blast doing this. Thank you once again for inviting me onto your show. I truly appreciate coming on here and discussing these movies with you. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about something. I mean, even though Frankenstein is a horror film, to get to talk about something like Weird Science, which is a comedy, because I've kind of categorized myself as action horror guy. And, I love action and I love horror. I mean, I love movies in general, I love talking about movies. But I never really get opportunities to talk about movies outside of action horror. Like my good buddy Michael Cook over in the Hit Rewind podcast, he allows me to talk about movies. Like I've talked about movies like Just One of the Guys and My Science Project, two of my favorite movies. But like, I really don't get these many opportunities. So I thank you greatly for allowing me to come on and talk about something, you know, that to show that, you know, yes, I love movies outside of action and horror, you know.
No, and you brought that exact same of insight that you do to action and horror that you do to weird science, which was absolutely great and wonderful. It was so much fun talking to you. I will absolutely have you back anytime you want to come on.
I would love to be back. I would definitely love to be back. And we'd love to have you over on the Action Drunkies and the House That Screams if you ever want to come over. I know, like, you know, the time zones are wonky, like, between from over here and you over there. But we would love to have you on and to discuss these, you know, like, you want to talk about action on Action Drunkies, you want to talk about horror and House That Screams. We would love to have you.
Oh, thank you so much. No, I would love that because both shows are absolutely wonderful. And
Thank you.
No, I will definitely, absolutely be up for that. Do you want to tell everyone where they can find you?
Oh, of course. You can find me as The Cinema Drunkie on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can find my show, The Action Drunkies, on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. You can find The House That Screams at House_Screams. The host of that show, my dear friend Candy, the final girl, she runs that account. So like, if you ever have any messages or questions for her, she is the one that you will be talking to. She handles all that stuff. You can find it also on Facebook and Instagram. You can find her as Candy, the final girl. The show doesn't have an official Instagram because she reveals details about the show through her personal Instagram account, Candy, the final girl. Big shout out to I wanted to shout out also my brother Mac the All-Star, who is my co-host on the Action Drunkies. You can find him at Mac the All-Star on Twitter and Instagram. Also, of course, a shout out our buddy Mike Scott from Atkins Undisputed.
Yes,
our dear friend.
Yes,
I can't say enough good things about Mike. I love that guy.
Oh.
And I just had my episode Atkins Undisputed about Ninja 2, my favorite Scott Atkins films, premiere. It seems to be from what I heard from Mike, it seems to be doing very well. Apparently, people like me talking about Scott Atkins because the amount of love I received for that episode had me feeling mushy. Like I could not believe it that people would just, I mean, me and Mike talking, you know, is just when me and Mike get together, we have fun, you know, especially talking about a subject that we both love as Scott Atkins. But Mike said it's doing great, and I'm glad you guys enjoyed the episode. And me and Mike will definitely be collaborating soon. He's coming back for more Action Drunkies, and I'll be finding a way to sneak back onto Atkins Undisputed, even though that was my final episode. I'll find a way to sneak back on there. Don't worry.
I'm glad to hear it because that was a really fun episode. You two talking about action is just a delight upon delight because both of you know exactly what you're talking about. And I recommend it. Please listen to Atkins Undisputed if you haven't, because it is an amazing show, as well as Action Drunkies. But you two together, it was a special kind of magic. I was just like, I'm learning so much. I need to be taking notes.
Thank you. I'm glad you appreciated it. I know Mike does too.
No, and thank you so much for coming on. Please listen to the Action Drunkies and the House That Screamed, because they're both really insightful and amazing podcasts. If you want to follow Shock and Awe, Twitter, Instagram, Shock and Awe 1. I'm just usually posting dopey doubles. If you want to follow me, it's at Reading Geek on Twitter. And on Letterboxd as well, Reading Geek as well. Mars, we're just doing shout-outs. I just want to shout out Daniel on his rebranding of Cobwebs, which has been doing amazing things at the moment.
Yes. I will be on that shortly.
Oh, excellent. Yay.
Yes. Me and Daniel will be chatting about The Lady Vanishes very shortly.
Oh, that is so, so great. This might come out after that because I've been banking up some episodes, but I'm really looking forward to, I'm glad you've said it. And his YouTube channel, he's been going strength to strength. And of course, also Matt on Film Feast and Chris Otato at the inside the sequel, just because they're all great guys, all doing great work. There's so many talented people who are very amazingly great people as well, including yourself. So that's just another episode of Schlock and Awe. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you back with another double. Okay, bye guys.